Welcome, members and guests, to the October 23rd program of the City Club of Eugene. Twitter and tweets, what's happened to the news? Thank you for joining us. I'm James Baldock, City Club President. Our sponsors today are Pacific University, Funk and Leaves Associates, Marketing and Public Relations, and KLCC. Special thanks go to KPFF Consulting Engineers for supplying our office space, and to KLCC Radio for airing these programs at 6:30 on Monday nights and for archiving the podcast on their site. We'd also like to thank Community Television of Lane County for televising recent City Club programs Monday through Friday at noon, Saturday at 10:30 a.m., and Sunday at 9 p.m. A quick reminder that we host nearly 50 original nonpartisan issue programs every year, and today is our seventh program in our 2015-2016 programming year. If you believe with us that civic engagement is the lifeblood of democracy, please join us. We welcome donors, sponsors, members, volunteers, and students, anyone who has a stake in community life. Today's program, Twitter and Tweets, What Happened to the News, is coordinated by Mary Layton. Our guest speakers today are John Stark, Camelia Mortensen, and Mark Blaine. Our past president, Marlene Nessery, would like to address the membership briefly before I introduce the speakers.
Thank you, James. This is just a quick update on our new Alliance for Civic Education. We briefly mentioned this project at our September 11th program, but it really got started last year when we were planning for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor's visit. We found such strong interests from so many Oregonians, and civic education turned out to be a timely and relevant topic, and such a timely and relevant topic that we've launched a $50,000 project. Our goals are to train and mentor young adults from diverse communities with leadership potential and interest. We're calling them the Civic Associates. To help them mentor and work with K-12 students from all over Lane County, our Civic Scholars. And to roll up that activity and energy into a springtime celebration of civic education that we're calling the Democracy Olympics. We hope to attract a Sandra Day O'Connor caliber speaker to keynote the festivities. We're envisioning student showcases, perhaps an expo of social studies, government, and service learning projects, debate and translation tournaments, mock trials and city council presentations, pitching sessions for new neighborhood projects, professional development opportunities for teachers and social entrepreneurs, and other activities we can't yet imagine. Between now and then, we expect new input on our weekly programs, new faces on the podium, and new young members helping to shape the conversation. I want to thank the following early adopters for their generous financial contributions: Robin Fletcher, Sally Glennon, Lynn Hockley, Karen Hyatt, Anita Johnson, Barbara Kustra, Joel Corin, Ed Layton, Mary Layton, Ruth Miller, Marlene Nessery, Karen Seidel, Frank Sobel, Marty Wilde, and Rose Wilde. Our thanks as well to local employers who were quick to grasp the relevance of citizenship skills to business success and have written letters supporting the Alliance for Civic Education project. These include Jack McCarchick, Board President, Oregon Country Fair; Paul Berger, President, Saves Us, and Managing Director, Score for Reading; Celeste Edmond, CEO, Lunar Logic; and Darby Giannone, founder, Pacific Benefit Planners, and the Japanese Immersion School, Eugene Japanese Immersion School. For more information on the project, please follow the link toward the bottom of City Club's homepage, or else email me at civic-ed@cityclubofeugene.org. Thank you for your time and attention. Now back to James and today's program.
Thank you, Marlene. Please join me in welcoming our speakers. John Stark brought nearly two decades of public radio experience to KLCC when he became its general manager in February 2013. Camelia Mortensen is an associate editor and investigative reporter within the Eugene Weekly. She is also a part-time instructor at Lane Community College, where she teaches composition and journalism. Mark Blaine is a senior instructor and journalism area director for the University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communication, where he has worked since 2003. Our program will start with John Stark.
Thank you. If you pay careful attention to the news, you will learn that media today faces serious challenges. Here are some headlines. Media analyst Clay Shirky writes, "Anybody who tells you newspapers have a future is lying." And this, "Declines in listening to NPR's Morning Edition among all ages under 65. Writing in last week's New Yorker magazine, Emily Nussbaum writes, "The television business model is in chaos. The times, they are changing. Radio is no longer referred to simply as radio. Instead, we are known as traditional or terrestrial radio, a legacy media to differentiate us from internet and digital radio. We face enormous challenges. Music stations compete with Pandora and Spotify, where users can program music for themselves. People are spending more time on their mobile phones and less with radio. The newest, potentially greatest disruptor is the connected car. Internet access on the dashboard. The connected car is already available on some new models. It will provide unlimited listening choices, the ability to listen to radio stations from anywhere in the world in your car, anytime, anywhere. KLCC and all public radio stations are not immune from disruption. We are no longer the exclusive source for public radio programs. Listeners and our network can now bypass our stations. Now, NPR is available streaming online on social media and podcasts. You can also time shift NPR. You can tune into Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me anytime, not just 11 on Saturday mornings. And there's more. The multimedia world places greater demands on the people in our newsroom. It used to be a reporter would research, conduct interviews, write and produce radio stories, and be done with it. Now, stories are transcribed and rewritten for reading, posted on the website and on social media, sites such as Facebook and Twitter, shared with other stations. They have to be a photographer as well. Faced with all the disruption, some longtime radio professionals are saying, "Sal si puedes, leave if you can, go back to school, get a real estate license." Yet there are signs that the radio industry is in good shape. Radio reaches more than 90% of the American population each week, 68% daily. Revenues are flat, not plummeting, as in the newspaper industry. We say flat is the new up. NPR, public radio, and KLCC are strong. Solid journalism is our primary appeal. It's explanatory and fact-based. It helps listeners connect the dots. Our news is not sensationalist or partisan, and NPR is rooted in a network of 268 stations nationwide. KLCC has been on the air for 48 years. We're the third most listened to radio station in the Eugene market, with approximately 80,000 listeners each week. On the surface, all is well with KLCC, but we are vulnerable in the rapidly changing media environment. KLCC can't stand pat. The status quo is not an option. Right now is the perfect time for us to re-examine our service and make basic improvements. This past year, we put together a strategic planning committee with people from staff, Lane Community College, and the community to sift through data, analyses, and best practices to create a plan for the next 3 years. Our top goal is to strengthen KLCC local news, to cover Eugene like NPR covers the world. We are committed to investing in local news to increase in-depth coverage of our community and reflect its sense of place. We will build capacity by increasing news staff, create innovative new programming, emphasize quality over quantity. Now, KLCC has a full-time news reporter, Rachel McDonald. She was previously our Morning Edition host. We are focusing on producing in-depth news stories that not only discuss what happened, but also explain why, that prioritize voices of ordinary people over politicians and agency spokespersons, that utilize fresh storytelling styles. Our goal number two, assure financial stability, increase financial support with fundraising. We are committed to producing powerful and effective on-air fundraising. Our most recent accomplishment, the recently concluded stealth pledge drive. We met our goal and reduced the on-air pledge drive from 8 days to 4.5 hours. Our next step, form a 501c3 nonprofit community support board. It will assist with fundraising, grants, advocacy, outreach, so we can better serve the community. Goal three is expand KLCC's community engagement. A great example of KLCC's collaboration is our partnership with you, City Club of Eugene. Jim Dotson records City Club, and we broadcast these meetings Monday night at 6:30. Thank you, City Club, and thank you, Jim Dotson. Your programs are informative. We conservatively estimate that each week, more than 1,500 persons tune in to KLCC for City Club. KLCC collaborates with lots of other local organizations, the Oregon Bach Festival, the Wayne Moore Center, Food for Lane County, with our December Feed Your Radio, Feed a Family initiative. We're now focused on expanding our partnership with the UO Journalism School, with Mark Blaine and his colleagues. We are opening the doors to young people, the students, the digital natives who grew up with the internet. It's a role reversal, with the students teaching established professionals so KLCC can thrive in the digital age. The key to KLCC success going forward is to be locally responsive and accountable, but not provincial. Our strongest strategy is to present valued local, regional, national, and international programming and to embrace technological change. To steal a phrase, KLCC is not going away. We are going everywhere on all platforms.
Hi, I'm Camilla Mortensen with Eugene Weekly. Eugene Weekly is an alternative news weekly. Most larger cities have them. Portland or Seattle, they have one or two. Alt weeklies, or alts as they're known, have their roots in America's long history of alternative journalism and muckraking. Muckraking is actually a good thing. Muckrakers back in the early 1900s did investigative reporting, digging up the truth on anything from dirty politics to how patients were treated at mental institutions. In the 60s and 70s across the country, weekly papers were founded. People wanted something different from the mainstream media, and at the time, getting a paper printed was cheaper than ever. The papers presented radical politics and took on new journalism, the combination of nonfiction reporting with literary techniques associated with fiction writing, and they deepened a focus on storytelling. In the 70s and 80s, alt weeklies began adding arts and entertainment reporting that, in addition to investigative reporting, they're now known for. Eugene Weekly was founded in the early 1980s, basically as a calendar. It was then called What's Happening, which was probably cool in the 80s. Later, it was dubbed Eugene Weekly. It was locally owned at the time, and it's still locally owned by Art and Anita Johnson. Until just a short time ago, the third owner was Fred Taylor, a UOJ school grad who was then told by the dean of the journalism school at the time that he would actually never make it in the field of journalism. He should get out of it. In true alt-weekly style, he ignored the mainstream advice and forged his own path. He went on to become managing and later executive editor of the Wall Street Journal, and when he retired, he became a co-owner of the Eugene Weekly. He died this summer, and I truly miss getting weekly updates from Fred on what he thought of the paper each week. The first time he criticized something I wrote, he said my story was good, but I had let the nut graph until the end. Well, thank goodness for the internet, because after the editorial reading, I ran back to my office and frantically Googled nut graph, because I had absolutely no idea what that was. The nut is the paragraph in the feature story that tells the reader what the story is, what the news value is. And so, not to leave my nut graph until the end, the news value of an alternative weekly and the Eugene Weekly is our local focus, our connection to the community, our in-depth reporting and storytelling that, while affected by the digital age, isn't destroyed by it. Eugene Weekly currently prints an average of 40,000 papers a week. We have about 91,000 readers between copies of the paper getting read more than once and, of course, the internet. We drop our print edition off at 900 points around Lane County and Corvallis. Weirdly enough, and maybe as a testament to being an alt-weekly, and so being a little bit different, our print readership has actually increased. People still like to go down to our little red boxes and get a physical copy of the paper. And yes, later use them to start campfires or in their garden or as puppy piddle paper. Those needs don't go away. While daily papers have faced everything from the internet's effect on classified ads to the pressure to have nonstop news pumping out 24/7, readers have historically not picked up the weekly to find out the latest on Benghazi. They pick up the calendar to see what's up in town, and they read news with a voice and stories with depth. The challenge in the digital age is to be able to afford that. People still don't want to yet pay for stuff on the web, and if readership shifts more there, the trick is to get advertisers to pay for web ads what they pay for print ads, which is still significantly less. Sometimes when people talk about the internet and about print media, I feel like the internet gets characterized as some sort of friendly serial killer. Handsome, engaging, it draws you in, and then bam, newspapers, magazines, books, all dead. Except they're not. Before I became a reporter, I was a folklorist, which is why I didn't know what a nutgraph was. And actually, I'm still a folklorist, and journalism lets me indulge my love of storytelling each week. One story that I love is the Greek myth of Bellerophon. He was the fellow who tamed Pegasus, the winged horse. A lesser-known tale of Bellerophon is in Homer's Iliad. The wicked Proteus sends him to the nearby land of Lycia carrying a sealed scroll. On the scroll was written, "Soul-destroying Semata Lugra, baleful signs." Letters that instructed the ruler of Lycia to murder the unsuspecting Bellerophon. The written word in that oral epic was seen as deadly. Once the technology of writing was actually scary. For all our innovations, it turns out that humans have actually feared technology for a really long time. But our desire for news, alternative news, and good stories doesn't die. One thing that has long distinguished the weekly from mainstream news is that we have a voice and we're proud of it. One description that's been batting around our office for a while that was written by some staffers is this. Eugene Weekly serves the Eugene, Springfield, and broader community with zest, passion, and attitude as an alternative to the mainstream media. We proudly admit to practicing advocacy journalism with a point of view. The reality is that most media practices advocacy journalism with a point of view, but owners and editors deny it. It's a big difference that we admit to our bias. The Daily's paper's job, or one of them, is to provide you with ongoing, objective daily news. We might compete with the Register Guard for readers, but we don't ever want this community to lose the guard. If there aren't out there covering meetings, then we don't know what the city council and the county commission are up to. As the Alt Weekly, we fill in what the mainstream media misses. We provide an alternative angle. I also teach journalism at Lane Community College. One of the things I tell my students beyond follow the money, tell me what the news peg is look past the surface and see what else is out there. Read with a critical eye. Then when you've dug deeper, it's time to find a way to tell that story well. We also need a venue for telling those stories. Print costs are up and printers are going down. Maybe because there's less call for print, or maybe because newspapers are actually becoming fearful. The same printer that prints us prints the Oregonian because that big paper shut its own press down. At the same time, just a couple years ago, everyone was saying the internet had killed long-form journalism. The web had killed our attention span, and suddenly no one wanted those 5,000, 10,000 word in-depth stories. And that was wrong. Long-form journalism has actually grown more popular. When people tell me their favorite stories in the weekly, it's rarely the news briefs they remember. It's the long, in-depth investigative journalism, and I love that. I also love when people stop to tell me they really liked something, because I have to admit, people usually stop to tell me that we forgot the Sudoku this week, or they think they found a comma in the wrong spot. And judging from Instagram photos I've seen, a popular pastime in town is grabbing the weekly and sitting down, pen in hand, to hunt for typos. And I'm proud to say that with our small staff and no copy editor, we actually do pretty well. And I'm just going to let the grammar Nazis out there know that not using an Oxford comma or a serial comma is not a typo. That's Associated Press style. And you folks who want a comma before and every time, whether the sentence needs it or not, or even worse, the old school folks who want to put two spaces after a period every time, should know that those fights are print fights. Two spaces after a period was a technique used in the days of typewriters for clarity. News writers would rather have words than that extra empty space. AP style leaves out the Oxford comma, unless it's needed for clarity, to save print space. Sometimes white space in a paper makes for good graphics. But as writers, we jealously guard our space for words. Who knows if years from now we go entirely digital, maybe we'll have the entire sprawling internet for words, and our readers will find them somehow and read them. Right now, we're striking a balance between keeping up with the digital age by updating our blog with breaking news, tweeting, Facebooking, keeping up with social media, and still putting out a strong, fun, in-depth print paper. A paper that might piss you off, but hopefully makes you think. A paper where you can read the letters of your friends and neighbors, and then you can hop online and say snarky things about them anonymously. A paper where you or your kid shows up in an article, and then you still take the time to cut that article out and save it. We have to keep up with the digital age, but keeping up with technology doesn't mean fearing it, or killing what's good about what we already have. As long as there's a venue for good stories and in-depth reporting, we will provide it. If you give us the space, we will give you our words.
Hi, I'm Mark Blaine. We've been here before. Between 1857 and 1867, that's 1857 and 1867, the value of Western Union grew by 11,000% because of one thing. Suddenly, you didn't need someone to show up on a horse to give you the news. But there were strings attached, literally copper wires. Bandwidth was a huge issue and necessitated a whole system of abbreviating words and numbers that were represented by multiple dots and dashes, tapped out by a human. Lines across rugged country and ocean expanses would go dead. They paid by the character, so they kept what they had to say short. Often they used a kind of code to save time and money. The new medium shaped the form that breaking news took in the local paper. But the local papers, for the first time, had access to news that happened minutes, not weeks, ago. Mix in a general increase in the standard of living and the growth of cities, and throw in the Linotype. Suddenly, there's a huge increase in up-to-date news and information, and that's a century and a half ago. The first official message between D.C. and the financial center of Baltimore in 1844 was, "What hath God wrought?" OMG. Since 2010, the number of monthly active users on Twitter has grown tenfold because news no longer has to land with a thud at your door or with the staticky warm-up of a television screen. Instead, it comes in the moment as a buzz in your pocket. This isn't a plug for Twitter, despite the title of our presentation, but there are some interesting parallels between the rise of the telegraph and the rise of Twitter. Brevity, bandwidth, concerns about things going too fast, rapid growth. Twitter is an example of the disruption the news business is facing. It represents our telegraph. We're going really fast again, and we're trying to work out how that looks. Newspaper advertising was up big last quarter, 16%. Maybe that's a relief. Ad revenue, however, has fallen by half in the last decade, and the money has largely been lost to digital. Local television is still doing pretty well, and with an election season heating up, all those political ads will make a huge difference to the budgets of local stations. The challenge, however, will be to face the colder light of 2017, because disruption isn't going away, and we're changing the way we interact with media. And it's going to keep going that way. Digital gets a lot of blame, but digital isn't one thing. First it was the web, then social, then mobile. Now there's more than talk of VR. That's why I bring this prop. This is called Google Cardboard. And I'll just describe it for radio. It's one of Google's newest things. It unfolds, Velcros like this. It's all made of cardboard. Your phone fits in here. Put it like that, and you do that, and you've got virtual reality. Wow. You know, you think about, this is emphatically not shiny. You know, you think about all of the ways that technology is presented as this new kind of appendage that we might have, this shiny thing, VR in particular, a helmet. Particularly even today, the day after Back to the Future Day, when we were vetting many of the 1985 movie's shiny predictions, it's interesting to think about how Google is presenting this technology with humble cardboard. The idea, again, is not to make it shiny or fancy, to give us a cyborg-like kind of arm or helmet. In some ways, it's like launching an iPhone with a nicely designed pair of cans and a string in a pretty box. It's gee whiz for the overstimulated. My point here today is not to say that we need to be early adopters or that we should all be technologists of some sort. We should, however, understand that significant disruption keeps coming. We've been disrupted before and managed it, and it never quite turns out the way we expect it. Although right now, I will say that any media outlet that isn't getting up to speed on mobile, both phone and wearable, is probably already behind. And that's not to say that every outlet should go full on into mobile development, but the choice not to is a strategic one. Mobile won't kill print either, but it's going to take a significant chunk of it. We will lose things, yes. We will gain, certainly. I'm still hopeful about the diversity of news sources that the early web promised. Diversity of sources is a good thing. And now we're branching out across platforms and reimagining what we want and need. With video, for example, is it Walter Cronkite style most trusted man in America approach? Or was that the it of the moment when we had three networks and a blossoming PBS and NPR and the captive attention of the nation? Or is it now Vox Media's social-friendly pass-along explainer videos about Obamacare? Or is it Vice's cheeky and social-friendly voice? Or is it Periscope's ability for anybody to live feed from the scene of news? Or is it a GIF of a Hungarian journalist tripping a refugee and child? Perhaps more interesting than the whack-a-mole of technology, however, is the experimentation in business models. NPR and stations like KLCC pioneered the nonprofit news model several decades ago. Now we have others, ProPublica being a notable example of nonprofit news. In this case, a team of high-level investigative journalists digging in data to uncover national stories with searchable local implications. Or the Marshall Project, another nonprofit partner-developing initiative to report on criminal justice issues. Or regionally with the Texas Tribune and others. These sites don't typically try to cover everything like a traditional news outlet would. They flip what traditional news is. They call their shots, and they dive deeply into specific issues. They leverage data for efficiency in reporting deep stories. They're following models that are as much business as ethos. They maintain home sites and push stories out the traditional way, but they also partner with other news organizations to leverage audiences in ways that the traditional models of news didn't do. Will it work? The better question is, will it adapt? This is an era when the disruptors are being disrupted. What disruption also requires, however, is public demand. That's what will fuel the business models. And public demand means a new level of curiosity and critical thinking from all of us about the news and the news sources we encounter. As someone who teaches journalism, I'm going to argue for a greater role in education for developing critical consumers of news and other media. We have to move beyond passive consumption and into a new era of engagement. That means printing and broadcasting stuff, but it also means finding other ways to help information flow in a community. Those other ways will likely be some combination of face-to-face interaction, like this today, facilitated by digital innovation, where we can keep the conversation going and help people make informed decisions in a democratic society. In the big, bad digital world, local news outlets have the advantage of being of the place, and in some ways, having reduced competition. Smaller town newspapers have tended to fare better than regional ones. KLCC just hit it out of the park with its stealth drive. People are passionate about place and want to be connected to their homes. Despite the rise of VR, like this, those are pretty analog qualities that aren't going away. There's a ground-up model that will be interesting to see how it develops. As journalists start to develop greater technical skills, nowadays, if you can write a story and you can speak the language of coders, you can write your ticket. Journalism will also change. The need for tech skills in journalism seems at the face one of changing platforms, what we often complain about. But understanding how to navigate all that is digital is really what the change is here. There's a deeper power there as more journalists grow the ability to access and ask the right questions of data sets and their keepers. And I'll leave it there for the moment because I can go on. Thank you.
All right, and thank you. Today's topic is Twitter and Tweets, What Happened to the News? Our speakers are John Stark, General Manager of KLCC, Camilla Mortison, Associate Editor of the Eugene Weekly, and Mark Blaine, the Journalism Area Director for the School of Journalism and Communication at the University of Oregon. We'll break now for a few minutes and then return with members' questions.
You're listening to KLCC NPR for Oregonians in Eugene, 89.7 FM KLCC, KLCO Newport, 90.5, KLFR Reedsport, 89.1, and at 88.1, KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet.
Welcome back to the October 23rd City Club program, Twitter and Tweets, What Happened to the News? Our guest speakers are John Stark, Camilla Mortison, and Mark Blaine. City Club members, please identify yourselves and keep your questions to about 30 seconds each.
Hello, I'm Marty Wilde, past president and City Club member since 2010. As newsrooms have shrunk and the news has had to rely more on citizen reporting or, you know, lay people reporting, those reports tend to come in with a bias because people are at these meetings because they have a viewpoint. What's the best partnership you've heard about between sort of the general public bringing things to your attention and your role as professional journalists in making that more objective or shaping that?
Public radio stations always used to be standalone, and we would compete with neighboring public radio stations. We have learned to play and work with others so that, for instance, KLCC works very closely with OPB in Portland and with Jefferson Public Radio and stations throughout the entire region. So we have found that we can, by partnering and collaborating with others, we can generate a lot more material. So we are having great success with partnerships.
I would say Eugene Weekly doesn't necessarily use a lot of citizen journalism per se. We do use freelancers, and we have interns that have actually gone on to some pretty great places, including CNN, The Oregonian, some other places that we've trained up. But one thing we do is we print a lot of letters to the editor, and we print viewpoints. And the letters to the editor are popular, whether you're angry at them or not, and that's a place where I think citizens in Lane County really get a chance to bring their story forward and to get things out there.
I'm going to spin that just a little bit and kind of get in to talk just briefly about comments sections and things like that in online news in particular. And I think that we're still trying to work out sort of what the right, you know, level is, because there are a lot of trolls out there who are on the extreme end of that. But there are also, you know, as in any sort of in-person kind of communication, there are people who dominate. And there are people who quietly have really important things to say who maybe don't speak up. So, you know, you've really got to try to figure out how to calibrate those things. And some news organizations have turned them off completely. Others keep them on. You know, and then, you know, that was kind of an early form. Now you open the door with social and that interaction. You know, I think that's one that's ongoing and just challenging for us to deal with. But, you know, on the other side of that, I think it's a great moment as well. You know, I would like for us to think that we, have the potential for a much more diverse set of voices who are out there, and hearing those, and not saying, oh, well, just because that appeared in the paper, that's the kind of voice of God. You know, like, let's get different viewpoints. You know, let's not be so passive about this. And listen to different things. And we have the ability now to consume and get a lot of different angles. Whether people do or not, that's another question.
Hi, I'm Paul Thompson. I've been a Cine Club member on and off since 2003. The conversation at our table centered around the question of accuracy. And as you visualize this cornucopian horn of information that's coming at us, it seems like there's quite a lack of editorial support and fact-finding and so on. And perhaps you could comment on what you think the trend's going to be in increasing the validity of what we hear. And if the model is a buyer beware, that the individual has to be concerned, if that's the case, then what comment would you have about needing to teach critical thinking in our schools?
Radio listeners can't see it, but I made a look of absolute horror at the thought of buyer beware. I think that's actually a major way of pointing out the need for newspapers and that we hold ourselves accountable. We try to hold each other accountable. One of the things the Weekly does is we nip at the heels of the Register Guard and try to hold them accountable in their coverage. And they were invited to be here, but they were unable to be here and be one of the presenters. I am horrified when I'm inaccurate. And even with a small staff, we go to great lengths to check our accuracy, and when someone writes and says we're inaccurate, we put that in the paper, we fix it on the web, and make sure that we are held accountable. I think critical thinking and having people realize the difference between a blog post that's been put out without being fact-checked and a newspaper article that has been written and gone over and investigated is something that does need to be taught in the school, sort of a form of news literacy.
I'd jump in. I was thinking and avoided it to not bore you guys in my talk about bringing up the innovator's dilemma and Clayton Christensen and the idea that When you have a disruption of whatever industry, the new thing that comes along is often, in a lot of ways, not as good. You know, it's kind of like, why is that not so great thing starting to beat this other thing? But it enters into the market, and then it starts leveling up as it goes. And I think that I'd like to hope that we're in a space now where we're hopefully, with the disrupted media and the diversity of sources that are out there, the next competitive advantage that outlets are going to have is editing. You know, sharper focus on quality, because that tends to be what happens. You know, first it's, yeah, we can do the web, then it's, well, so everyone's doing the web, so then how do you differentiate that? Well, the good players, the sharper ones, the well-edited ones, will start to percolate up. It's so new, though, right now, that that hasn't gotten as much traction as maybe we would like to have.
I would simply add that editors are a unseen, not apparent asset in what is characterized as the mainstream media. And the job is to make sure that it is factually correct, grammatically correct, and a lot of media that's out there on the web, on mobile, is not fact-checked and not reliable.
Hi, I'm Tegra Fisk, City Club member since this last July. Thank you all for your work in the community. You make a big difference in our local culture. So this is a two-part question that's a kind of a compilation of a lot of interest that my table had. The first part of the question is, how common is it for journalists to write courageous, opinionated, honest pieces, just in your experience? And also, what is the history of journalistic non-neutrality in being defended in local courts or United States courts? Thanks. Is that clear, that second question?
People
who are writing those courageous pieces, are they being libeled in court, or what is the history of the justice system kind of being behind journalists or not behind those journalists?
And I think this might be more Camilla's power alley than public radio and KLCC, because we tend not to have a lot of opinion pieces, courageous opinion pieces, as you mentioned. We are public media. We are in part federally funded, and what we focus in is less opinion, more on presenting the facts.
I'll write as many courageous, groundbreaking pieces as that can possibly fit into the paper. I guess there's a little bit of a difference maybe between opinion and maybe point of view journalism. I think everyone has an opinion, and suppressing the opinion is a difficult thing to do. But we definitely do journalism with a distinct point of view. I started off at The Weekly as an environment reporter, and we are very decidedly pro-environment at the Eugene Weekly. And we're going to lean pro-environment and go out and do that. But it gets to the earlier question about accuracy. I might have a point of view. I might be pro-environment, pro-saving the cougars, pro-whatever else. But I need to be accurate, because that is what keeps me from being libelous, because it's only libelous if what I print is not accurate, and if I print it knowing it's not accurate. And accuracy is a huge part, and I think in some ways it's more difficult to do good point of view journalism, because you need to be, all your T's have to be crossed, your I's have to be dotted, even more so, I think, than if you were putting forth a claim of objectivity. In terms of the courts, I think whether point of view or not, all courageous investigative journalism, whether it be objective or non-objective, finds itself in court from time to time, because when you're digging up things that people don't want to hear or prefer you not to say, they will sometimes try to take you to court for it. I'm going to knock on wood, because I have not yet ever been taken to court. And I'm going to keep it that way, I think.
I would add in with that, I mean, I think it also very much depends on the deep pockets of the news organization that's behind you. As someone who's gone to court to sue to get records, my owner supported me in doing that when I was in North Carolina. And the ability to go and do that is one thing, but the owners who owned the paper before that would not have. So it's a difference in budgetary priorities in some ways. and tolerance of risk. The other thing I would jump in and say, though, I don't, you know, courageous and honest stories should never be libelous. You know, I mean, that's they need to be accurate. And, you know, libel law, you know, is there to be a check on gross inaccuracies.
Yeah, Joe Koswick, City Club member. The question of big data. Wonder if you get approached to sell your membership list to people that are putting together the big data.
And I'm taking that as a question for KLCC. We have over 4,000 people in our membership database, and we do not share our membership with anyone. In fact, that's mandated by Congress. They have explicitly said, and we have to certify, that we do not share membership because it could be subject to abuse. So we simply don't do it.
This question, I'm John Anik, a City Club member since 2003, and many, many moons ago a journalist. I was inspired by recent events. I noticed that the Koch brothers are sponsoring a good portion of science programs at public television, and recently they purchased the National Geographic magazine. And which leads me to ask, what, in your opinion, what major groups and areas of interest are poorly represented in journalism today?
I'm not sure if I'm following your question correctly, but I can off the top of my head say that there's a lot of groups that need better representation in journalism, and I think that most of us do try to provide that representation, but people of color are very much underrepresented. Native Americans in Oregon are very underrepresented in journalism, both as journalists and in reporting their stories. You are seeing, and I think in a large part thanks to Occupy getting the word out, a lot more attention being paid to low-income, middle-class, and the homeless and unhoused. But that's an issue that needs more attention if we're ever going to fix it.
One of the recent developments in broadcasting is the emergence of low-power FM. And Eugene has a couple of stations in the works, including Country Fair. And that is intended to give more people voice in broadcasting, because radio broadcasting is relatively inexpensive compared to television. And low-power FM can give voice to people in communities, to young people, to people of color. And so it's a great opportunity.
Jane Gander. I've been a member of City Club since about 07, I think. And this question from our table is kind of related to what you're talking about, which is, how does the ownership, whether it's corporate or private, affect the objectivity of news reporting? And as I was reading this question that a non-member wrote, I recalled a publisher that I worked for one time when he was approached by an advertiser who wanted editorial coverage. He just looked the guy in the eye and said, "But if I do that for you, I'll have to do it for everyone, and then who will read the magazine?" So I'm wondering how that applies with the newspapers, particularly in the radio.
I can start off if you like. I guess it's sort of a two-part question. First of all, the effect of advertising. There's a wall in newspapers between advertisers and the editorial staff. I literally don't see the advertisements because when I'm proofreading things on page, the ads are not yet there. We do get calls from people saying I take out an ad, and I love the people that take out an ad, but it doesn't affect our news coverage or what we're going to cover or we're not going to cover. We're going to cover if someone is advertising with us and they're doing something bad, we're going to expose it. That's a good thing, and that's the job of the paper. And actually, I admire even more the advertisers who don't necessarily like what we have to say, but keep advertising because they like the fact that we say it or they like how many people out there read it. The second half would be the ownership, and I can't speak for the larger paper. We're a small paper, locally owned, and I think it's amazing that in this community we have the Registered Guard, which is locally owned, and Eugene Weekly, which is overly locally owned. And Anita Johnson, who's here, is a lively and wonderful presence in the newsroom, and I think that adds to us in the sense that she would still like us to win the Pulitzer, and I would like to win the Pulitzer, and if that's ownership influence, I think that's a wonderful ownership influence.
This is an interesting question for public broadcasting, where 60% of the public radio stations are licensed to, owned by universities and colleges and school boards across the country. And there is a firewall, as Camilla mentioned, that exists between the owners, the universities, and the radio stations. So we are not mouthpieces. We are not Izvestia or Pravda that are marching out the corporate, the company line. And in fact, it's very clear that in the few isolated circumstances where a college asks the public radio station to be a propaganda arm, the staff left. They quit.
I would add just a quick twist to nonprofit news and kind of models in that way, which often are kind of held up as sort of separate from influence because they're nonprofit and they're noble. It can be dangerous for also for large donors to be a big chunk of the operating budgets of some of those organizations as well. It can be dangerous, but it can also kind of push certain types of coverage in certain ways because the donor wants it in that way. So, the firewall has long been a tradition of sort of journalistic integrity. But as we start branching into new models and things like that, I think there is a real need for transparency about where that money is coming from and what's it for.
Kathy King, unlike some other nations, why have American mainstream and alternative media, strongly influenced by powerful telecom industries, failed to study and publicize negative effects of digital technology on socialization, including family interactions, and negative effects especially on youth, seniors, electro-hypersensitive, and the 10% of the population that have medical implants? This influence from a proliferating microwaves by digital technology and smart automobiles and more to come.
Well, I think we're awaiting you to tell us more about the story so we can cover it. Tell us more.
I have plenty to say, but not here. Yeah.
I can jump in. When there's meetings about it, we publicize it. When there are letters about them, we publish it. When there is updated news on it, we do the news story. If the Guard doesn't cover it, then we jump in and cover it. If the Guard covers it, we sit back and applaud them for jumping in and doing it. And those who are, it's the squeaky wheel, those who are persistent, and I know, Kathy, I've met you, you're persistent, will continue to get the coverage.
Okay. It's our future generations we're talking about. Thank you.
Lisa Arkin, City Club member. So at our table, we were lucky enough to have one of Camilla's students, and we agreed that there's a certain wisdom now out there that we're in a scroll communication culture, as fast as you can scroll, and that the bottom line is you have 6 seconds to get someone's attention and teach them something. And speaking from, my role as a communicator also in this community, how are we going to teach people to become civically engaged if we only have 6 seconds? And that's what we're being told by consultants and professors and all sorts of things. So if you can comment a bit about the scroll culture and the 6 second look. Thank you.
As someone who's an extreme proponent of long form narrative, I'd also like to think that within the first 6 seconds of a really great story, you're hooked. And I think that that's something that we need to be thinking about as we construct our stories and write. I think what you're talking about with the scroll culture and all of being so bombarded is a huge challenge that we're dealing with. I do think, though, there is a move the other direction in when you look at publications like Medium, that there are more outlets for longer form now than there have been in, you know, in a decade or more. I have my master's degree in long form narrative writing, and 20 years ago, 15 years ago, the outlets for getting published there were fairly narrow, and now it's really growing. And you look at radio, for example, the rise of a program like Serial, which is very long form. You know, I think that we're creating those opportunities as well. So, I would leave it at that we've always had the imperative to write catchy at the front end to get people in, you know, and I think it's even more extreme now, but we should be backing that catchiness up.
We should always, I guess, depend on research over anecdote. But one thing I always check with my students is I ask them if they're watching television, how long do they give a 30-second commercial before they switch the channel? And that's not very, it's that 6 seconds. If they walk in to watch a movie, how long do they give that movie before they walk out? And it's more like 6 or 10 minutes. You respond to the length of what it is you're sitting down to take a look at. So if something is long, you give it a longer time before you scroll away. And I think one thing that a trap we can fall into in the digital age is that Twitter trap. On the one hand, Twitter is wonderful because it makes you concise. On the other hand, I don't think it should let us fall under the illusion that we only have those couple seconds. We actually do have a little bit longer if we give them that little bit longer. There is that wonderful moment when someone sits down and opens up a book and still opens up the print paper, and there's sort of this, I have it all the time, this sort of delicious moment of, I'm going to sit down for a long read. And I give that long read more than 6 seconds before I decide if I'm going to continue or not. And I think that's something that we need to keep paying attention to.
We recently had the president, the CEO of NPR, here in Eugene, and he addressed this issue. And the strategy for attracting young listeners, the prevailing wisdom has been that you have to have material that's geared to short attention. And he questions this, that it's not about attention, is that there is ample attention among young people with alleged short attention spans, but it's about content, it's about the quality of content. So, indeed, if it's a commercial, it's altogether possible that people are going to tune out within 6 seconds. But if it's an engaging film, piece of writing, long-form journalism, radio piece, then it will stick.
Hi, I'm Josh Burstein, City Club member and board member. And those last two answers actually lead to our question. Our table discussion was about things like people receiving news from Jon Stewart or from Twitter or from other social media and demographics. The question is, and at our table, we polled ourselves and found almost all of us have smartphones and almost all of us read newspapers, meaning actual papers. I guess you call them print newspapers, whatever. Anyway, the question is, as a way of staying relevant, how successful can media be in getting its content out to people of all these different demographics who receive their news in different ways? For example, are there generational differences that you've already alluded to, or economic differences, people who may not be able to pay for a daily newspaper or have the technology at home to go online or do things like that? How would media companies get out this information to these people of different demographics and different platforms? And as a newspaper reader myself, I even cringe at the term platform or content, but I get it. How can you reach these different people, and how successful is it? Is it even possible to be successful in this new world that we're in?
One of the issues we really haven't touched on during this discussion is the segmentation of media, is that once upon a time, a newspaper would be read by all the people in the community, and now there's just a proliferation of different sources, and different people are going to different news sources, so that it's impossible to be all things to all people, and that's part of the changing media paradigm.
There's a phrase that I really wish that the advertising folks would come up with a better way of saying it, because every time I say it, I feel like I'm saying something terribly dirty, which is market penetration. It just sounds bad to me. I had to have it explained to me, which is basically how many people in your market are reading you. And actually, over the years, at least as far back as 2007, when I look back at it, Eugene Weekly's had really high market penetration for an alt-weekly. We're usually in the top three to the top five in alt-weeklies across the country. And that's mainly where our strength is currently, it's in print. But there's also, I think, a deftness you have to get that information out across those platforms you're talking about. And a recent discussion that's come up has been ebooks, that suddenly it doesn't seem like ebooks are killing the publishing industry after all, and no one can really figure out why. But one of the answers to that, which actually I heard about on NPR, was that people are reading books in multiple platforms now. And I think that's something that we have to pay attention to, is getting those words out in these multiple platforms.
I also think a danger that we face with this is that as the devices and platforms proliferate, we can get a lot more data on a smartphone than we can on a newspaper. And so there is a risk with certain audiences that maybe not advertisers don't see them as attractive, you know, aren't going to be consumers of their products, kind of the attention shifting away from those audiences because the money's not there and the content sort of follows the audience with the money. And as we refine our ability to kind of slice and dice audience metrics, you know, I think that's a real danger that we need to look at. You know, we won't have the generalist newspaper of the old days. Although I think it's really interesting that we have this idea that there, you know, in the last 20 years or so, that the kind of the idea of the one newspaper town is sort of the norm. And when I went to journalism school, people were lamenting the idea that mm-hmm. there were multiple newspapers in town. I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, where there was the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and the St. Louis Globe-Democrat, which meant there were two competing papers when I was there, but at some point there were four. You know, so if you kind of do the family tree of all that stuff, you kind of look back a little bit, 100 years, more than that actually for those papers. You know, there was a diversity of sources at one point. So, you know, and what were each of those catering to and who were they? I think it was probably a little bit more of a shot in the dark at that time, but now we have the scary ability to say, I want those 27 people right there. So.
Stephanie Harger, City Club member. Thank you for being here. The question from our table came from a professor of social work at Pacific University, and that is, do news organizations, perhaps beyond the low-power FM that you spoke of, have a responsibility to bring more of the local community news that would keep citizens informed of efforts by, you know, nonprofits, educators, city initiatives, the things that affect us as a community that aren't necessarily deemed, if you would, maybe buzzworthy enough to make it into the Register Guard or the Eugene Weekly? Is there a responsibility there to inform the population of that? And if so, how would that best be done?
I think both the Guard and the Weekly would say that our responsibility is to getting the word out about the community, whether it is something that is breaking news or something that is just something people should know about. Our calendar is sort of one of the best places that I point to for just getting the word out about something. It's free and it gets listed. If you don't have any money, you can walk in and you can hand it to us. If you have the internet, you can email it to us. If you have a phone, you can phone it to us and we'll get it in the calendar. We try to put things in Activist Alert, into BizBeat, and then sometimes we just try to write about stories about something we think people ought to know about, whether it's exciting in the sense of like someone's been murdered. No, we don't tend to cover that. We tend to cover things that are going on in the community, and we need to do more of it.
Thank you, John Stark, Camilla Mortison, and Mark Blaine for bringing clarity and vision to the City Club program. Twitter and tweets, what happened to the news? And thanks again to our sponsors. And thanks again to our sponsors, Pacific University, Funk Levis and Associates, and KLCC. We meet again on October 30th at the Downtown Athletic Club for What Should Happen in the Elliott State Forest with guest speakers Josh Lachlan of Cascadia Wildlands and Pete Shepard, General Counsel for the Confederated Tribes of Coos Bay. Lunches for the program can be ordered on the City Club's website or by contacting the office. We also have a special program that on November 13th called What's Up with Serbu that will be held at the Serbu location on Martin Luther King Boulevard across from Autzen Stadium. There is ample parking and bus service. Thank you.